From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Most of those with their hands on the levers of power are recycled Reaganites, and they have a record that we know a lot about. Those are facts that ought to be in the forefront of our attention, particularly because their record runs right through the 1990s as well, and not just in the United States.
Professor Noam Chomsky on terror, the United States, and empire. But first, an exclusive. Mumia Abu-Jamal conducts his first interview in 22 years. He talks to Lynn Stewart.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Lynn Stewart, it has been my pleasure to talk to you and to have others share our conversation, other than the government, of course.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Maryland, police have arrested two men believed to be suspects in the sniper shootings that have killed 10 and wounded 3 in the Washington, D.C. area. Early this morning, police arrested John Allen Williams, a 42-year-old Gulf War veteran, and his stepson, John Lee Malvo, 17. Last night, police named Williams, who's also known as John Allen Muhammad, as a suspect in the case and alerted drivers to be on the lookout for a 1990 Chevrolet Caprice. The men were found sleeping in a car in a Frederick, Maryland rest stop that matched the police description. The arrest followed a day of major developments in the sniper case, including searches of a duplex in Tacoma, Washington, and a paramilitary camp in Marion, Alabama. Sources said Muhammad once served at Fort Lewis in Washington State, not far from the site of a duplex where FBI and ATF agents searched the Tacoma home Wednesday and left with a tree stump apparently used for target practice. Military officials told CNN Muhammad was not trained as a sniper and was not in the special forces, but had expertise in combat support missions. In Alabama, Marion police said the property search was a training camp, Ground Zero USA, that specializes in urban warfare, martial arts, and SWAT tactics. Police did not elaborate on what, if anything, was taken from the property. Federal authorities are investigating whether a fatal shooting in Montgomery, Alabama, in September is linked to the sniper shootings in the Washington, D.C. area. Again, all of this information from the police. President George Bush said yesterday he's ordered the military to prepare for an attack on Iraq. This comes despite reports that the Pentagon's deployment of troops in the Persian Gulf region may have to slow to accommodate the re-entry of U.N. weapons inspectors. Bush reiterated he has still not yet decided whether to use force to oust Saddam Hussein. The president's comments came as he approved the largest increase in military spending since the Cold War. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the U.S. and Britain formally introduced their resolution on disarming Iraq to the full Security Council. One U.N. diplomat reported at least 7 of the 15 members of the Security Council categorically oppose the plan. This includes Russia and France, which both hold veto power. Critics say the resolution could be construed as giving the U.S. the authority to launch a military attack on Iraq if it refused to cooperate with the arms inspectors. The Security Council plans to continue the debate on Friday. Pentagon officials have revealed that after September 11th, they created their own intelligence unit separate from the CIA to focus on Iraq. Critics of the plan told the New York Times that War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and others are attempting to politicize intelligence to fit their hawkish views on Iraq. Many in the intelligence agencies disagree with the Pentagon that Saddam Hussein can be linked to al-Qaeda or that Saddam would unleash weapons of mass destruction before being attacked. Meanwhile, UPI is reporting that the CIA established 2 offices in Kurdish-controlled territory in northern Iraq. This marks the first time since 96 that the CIA has a formal presence in northern Iraq. In that year, the Clinton administration pulled the plug on a coup plot against Saddam Hussein, aided by CIA operatives. This according to former CIA officer Robert Baer's recent memoir, See No Evil. And the Washington Post is reporting the CIA is expanding its domestic presence by placing agents with nearly all of the FBI's 56 terrorism task force in U.S. cities. And you are listening to Democracy Now!, as we turn now to our first story, and that is an exclusive. for 22 years. Award-winning journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal has spoken to the world from Pennsylvania's death row. His writings and commentaries have made him a world-renowned figure known for racial equality and his activism against the death penalty. His books Live from Death Row, Death Blossoms, and All Things Censored have sold over 150,000 copies, been translated into 7 languages, as Mumia Abu-Jamal remains on death row. He was sentenced to death in 1982 for killing a police officer. He has been on death row ever since. He's always maintained his innocence. Well, last Saturday, Mumia Abu-Jamal anchored his first interview in 22 years from his cell at SCI Green Prison in Pennsylvania. In this exclusive interview, Abu-Jamal talks to attorney Lynn Stewart. She's currently under indictment by the U.S. Justice Department for, quote, materially aiding a terrorist organization. This for representing her client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. Stewart says the indictment, heralded by U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, seeks to destroy prisoners' constitutional right to counsel and suppress their First Amendment rights. We go now to that interview by Mumia Abu-Jamal of Lynn Stewart.
And
you are listening
good
to
Good afternoon, Mumia. What a pleasure this is.
It is a pleasure for us both, I hope.
I think so.
You have been, seems to me, singled out by the highest levels of the Justice Department for something that was not a crime, either now or even up until the signing of the infamous Patriot Act. Would you tell me what that was?
The Justice Department decided that things that I did as a lawyer are now to be outlawed, are now to be made into crimes in order to deter other lawyers from vigorously defending people. What I basically did was I issued a press release on behalf of my client. They said that this press release was a materially aiding a terrorist organization. And as they have accused so many others recently of that same crime, it seems to have no bounds whatsoever and can be used just about for anything.
So was this essentially illegal communication with your client?
Well, they had put on us a certain prison regulation. This is something Leonard Peltier also suffers under in the federal system. It's called a special administrative measure, which lawyers and clients, not clients, but people that we represent, must sign on to say that you will not communicate with the press on behalf of your client, thus making it impossible for any First Amendment right to be protected. In other words, Sheikh Omar was entombed in Minnesota. He was not allowed to communicate with anyone but his lawyers and his wife in Egypt once a month. We, in contravention of these regulations, did make press releases on his behalf, but it is only now that that has become an indictable offense.
Isn't this kind of a, on its face, violation of the First Amendment?
Isn't it? I couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, they hide everything behind that cloak of security within the prison, and now, of course, security for the whole nation. They are going to be the protectors of Americans, they who have done so much to make it impossible to protect this nation.
So is it not also a fact that the U.S. government, through the Justice Department, monitored your communications with your client?
Yes, this press release was in May of 2000. For the next 6 months, they went back and forth about whether they would let me in the prison again. They finally said, oh, yes, you can go in the prison, and we signed on to enter the prison again. Only, meanwhile, they had set up their cameras and tape recordings, so that every conversation that I had with Sheikh Omar by telephone or in the prison were monitored. They heard every word that was said in total derogation of the Sixth Amendment and, of course, the attorney-client privilege, which is part of that.
What appears as if that's not just vanishing in federal prisons, it's vanishing in state prisons as well. Is it not so?
Well, I think so. You know, the states, they are not very slow to follow any leads that Big Brother gives them. So I think that most lawyers nowadays are sort of looking over their shoulders and thinking to themselves, who may be listening in? And if that doesn't create a chilling effect, as you well know, between the communication between attorney and client, we all assumed they might be listening, but not that they might use these things as a basis for further prosecution.
I would hope that you have heard from a number of your colleagues who are in stark protest against this latest governmental action.
The New York Times wrote a piece in their magazine called Left Behind. I think more to encourage people to leave me behind than to... But of course, they've been saying the left has been dead in this country for many years. But to the contrary, we're alive and well, and I have gotten outstanding support, not only from the so-called radical or leftist lawyers of the National Lawyers Guild and other organizations, but from the everyday mainstream lawyers who understand that if we can't do this work, even within this racist criminal justice system, the way we have always done it, there will be no right to defend anymore. That right will just vanish. So I have gotten marvelous support. I once said that you have to die to find out how many people love you, but I'm getting it in this life.
Well, that's very good to know. I think that it should also, obviously, I think, be said that this is not kind of a lawyer's right. This is a right of the accused.
Absolutely. I
so
once said to a...
It affects thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, and perhaps millions.
I said to a young documentary maker, you know, it's really not about whether or not this can happen to you, but it really is about if it does happen to you, who are you going to call? Because there won't be a lawyer to call. The whole movement aspect of lawyering will disappear completely as they just knock us off one by one. And to me, that is the real essence of this work, is that we be permitted to lawyer in the way that we lawyered throughout the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and defend people such as yourself in these cases as political people, not just as defendant number 10872.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Lynn Stewart, it has been my pleasure to talk to you and to have others share our conversation, other than the government, of course. And I support you. And I think what you're doing is quite wonderful.
And I may say, Mumia, I support you wholeheartedly. I'm sitting in front of a beautiful banner with African cloth saying, Free Mumia and all political prisoners. And it has been my work for 30 years, and it will always be my work.
We're going to have to create a new banner saying, Free Lynn Stewart.
Yes, I'm for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All the best.
You too, dear. Bye-bye.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's interview with Lynn Stewart. It's his first in 22 years in prison when he's actually the interviewer. Lynn Stewart, indicted by the U.S. Justice Department for, quote, materially aiding a terrorist organization. She was indicted for representing her client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. That piece produced by Noel Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to Professor Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has been traveling the world since September 11th, speaking out on the issue of terror. He spoke last Friday night at University of Houston.
It's generally assumed that the events of September 11th changed the world dramatically, that nothing will ever be the same as we move into a new era of human history, an age of terror, as it was called. That's the title of the first book of academic essays that came out shortly after September 11th, Yale University professors mostly. They regarded the anthrax attacks, which they attributed to bin Laden, as even more ominous than what had happened at September 11th. And it's clear that the world has changed. So take, say, Iraq, what's on everybody's mind. Since September 11th, Iraq has become a threat to our very existence. So according to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, The next bit of evidence we're likely to discover about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction will be a mushroom cloud. She didn't say where, but presumably that means in New York or Washington. The neighboring countries don't seem to perceive the threat. Actually, they're worried, all right, but they're worried about the United States and its attack on Iraq, and not about Saddam Hussein. Interestingly, that's true even of Kuwait and Iran, two countries that were invaded by Saddam Hussein when he was a U.S. ally. The countries of the region are trying to reestablish relations with Iraq and reintegrate it into their system, so presumably they don't expect a mushroom cloud. Well, that's since September 11th. Before September 11th, we weren't facing that threat of destruction from Iraq, so surely September 11th changed something, brought about a major change, undoubtedly. If we want to understand the world, not just follow marching orders, we're going to ask what the change was. Was it a change in an objective threat? Was it a change even in a perceived threat? Or was it a change in opportunity? That is, an opportunity to pursue goals that are, in fact, longstanding. That's a pretty serious question. It should be the central topic of discussion and commentary, at least for those who want to understand the world, to get some picture of where it's going, and not simply to join a cheering section. And that's the question, the background question that I'm going to have in mind in these remarks. And many sort of side questions immediately come up. I mean, for example, the claim is that the problem with Iraq is that what we have to do is get rid of Saddam Hussein, regime change, eliminate the possibilities of any capabilities of developing weapons of mass destruction, maybe on the side, gain access to Iraq's oil. Well, if those are the goals, there are some simple ideas that come to mind about how to achieve them. They're not ever discussed. One might ask why they're never discussed. Could go on with that, maybe later if you're interested. But I'll keep to some more general, broader background issues about world order and about how we might proceed to understand it. Well, there's surely some truth to the idea that September 11th changed the world. The target on September 11th was not Cuba or Nicaragua or Lebanon or Chechnya or any of the other traditional victims of large-scale international terrorism. Rather, the target in this case was a state with awesome power to shape the future, in fact, power with absolutely no historical precedent. So it follows at once that if we want to gain a realistic picture of the likely future, we're going to investigate the U.S. government, its policies, its past policies, its present policies, and the roots of those policies in the institutions of the country. That's just elementary sanity, and that would be true no matter who happened to be in office. It's dramatically true when power is in the hands of people we know all about, people who have an ample record of exercising power. Most of those with their hands on the levers of power are recycled Reaganites, and they have a record that we know a lot about. Those are facts that ought to be in the forefront of our attention, particularly because their record runs right through the 1990s as well, and not just in the United States. So, take Richard Perle. People in the Washington Press Corps have told me that journalists there refer to him as Darth Vader. I can't vouch for that, but could be true. He's an influential planner now, as he was during the Reagan years. And a few years ago, 5 years ago, he was writing position papers for Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, who is well to the right of Ariel Sharon in the Israeli spectrum. And those connections are very close, the ultra-right in Israel and the power brokers here, as the Israeli press is commonly discussing. And the position papers that he and Doug Feith were writing, they have earlier roots, and they have a good deal of resonance in current geopolitical planning, geostrategic planning, going back to the 80s, in fact. Again, as the Israeli press, which is usually pretty well informed, has been pointing out. Well, those are things we ought to be thinking about. There are some other facts that should be prominent in our minds as well. One is that it has been recognized for some years, long before September 11th, that with new technologies, the rich and powerful states are going to lose their monopoly, virtual monopoly, of the means of violence. They'll retain an overwhelming preponderance, as they do, but it won't be a monopoly. So a couple of years before September 11th, just to quote one of many technical papers, it points out that a well-planned, I'm quoting, a well-planned operation to smuggle weapons of mass destruction into the United States would have a 90% probability of success, far greater than a missile attack, with or without national missile defense, even if it worked. That's what's been called America's Achilles heel, the title of a major book published a couple of years before September 11th by a number of well-known strategic analysts and technical experts. If you read the book, you'll find it's virtually a guidebook for terrorists, various things they could do. All of this has been evident, and in fact, it's been evident to everyone with their eyes open, at least since 1993. Remember that in 1993, groups related to Al-Qaeda tried to blow up the World Trade Center and came very close. Estimates are that with better planning, they could have carried it off and killed tens of thousands of people, and their ambitions were much broader. They also targeted the FBI building, the UN buildings, tunnels under the Hudson River. They were caught before they could do it, but they were on their way. And as I said, better planning might have succeeded. Well, the political leadership certainly knows that. U.S. intelligence certainly knew it as well. So did strategic analysts, and in fact, careful readers of the press were well aware of it. Also, the fact that a similar attempt was successful on September 11th does not really seriously affect the threat assessments. They were there before, and they remain, and the reasons for them are understood pretty well. There has been some success since September 11th in dismantling networks of the Al-Qaeda variety. By far the greatest success has been in Europe, primarily in Germany, through careful police work, which had some real successes. The bombing of Afghanistan, at least according to U.S. intelligence, had almost no effect. That was just reiterated in this morning's newspapers reporting the analysis by the George Tenet, CIA head, to Congress yesterday, who, according to the reports, says that the threats today are about the same as they were before September 11th, so whatever has been done hasn't changed that. There is a footnote to all of this. As the CIA pointed out a couple of weeks ago, just repeating the obvious, you don't need an intelligence agency to tell you this, the threats would increase, maybe significantly, if the U.S. were to attack Iraq. And that's for pretty obvious reasons. Put yourself into Saddam Hussein's shoes and you can figure it all out. The worst-case analysis, which is by no means unimaginable, is that what are called loose nukes might find their way into hands of fanatics bent on revenge, and remember the 90% probability of success. So there surely are ways of increasing the threats, and there are some folks not too far from here who are pursuing plans that are very likely to have exactly that consequence, as they perfectly well know. Well, on September 11th, the threats were realized with wickedness and awesome cruelty, to borrow the words of the most distinguished member of the Middle East International Press Corps, Robert Fisk, right away capturing the world reaction of shock and horror and sympathy for the innocent victims. And it was a major event, not only because of the scale. It's the first time in modern history, ever maybe, that the rich and powerful countries, the Western countries, have suffered on home soil atrocities of the kind that are unfortunately all too familiar elsewhere. The history should be familiar enough so that there's no need to review it. The West may prefer to forget it. The victims surely don't. That's a sharp break in the traditional pattern, and that means that it was a historic event of great importance. The repercussions are sure to be significant. Well, what the consequences will be, that'll be determined substantially by policy choices in the United States. So we're back to the obvious. If we want to understand anything, we will therefore begin with an investigation of U.S. power, how it's exercised, particularly in the very recent past up till now, how it's interpreted within the political culture. That's assuming minimal rationality. Actually, it's a minority opinion. It's considered so extreme that it scarcely appears within mainstream discussion, as you can determine for yourselves. And if it's even mentioned or noticed, it elicits near hysteria, which is, we can learn something from that. It's also illuminating to see how the record of the very recent past, how frequently it's even mentioned, let alone investigated in any serious way, in the reams of commentary on the so-called war on terror that was redeclared on September 11th. Let me stress, redeclared. It requires really impressive subordination to state violence not to notice that the war was actually declared 20 years earlier as the Reagan administration came to office with very much the same rhetoric and many of the same people in leading positions. Well, surely the record of the first phase of the so-called war on terror is relevant, highly relevant, to understanding the redeclared war, at least if understanding is preferred to blind faith. And that's particularly true because the shocking record of U.S.-backed international terrorism during those years continued in the years that followed, up to the present. But all that's buried deep in the memory hole, not, however, among the victims. It's also instructive to study the various devices that are used within the political and intellectual culture to overcome the threat of understanding. The simplest one is just deceit and evasion. Too many examples even to bother mentioning. A slightly less dishonest approach is the appeal to a kind of miraculous conversion. So according to this idea, yes, there were flaws in the past, but now they're overcome, so we can forget all that boring and irrelevant stuff about facts and other nonsense like that up to, say, 2 minutes ago, and we can march on to a righteous future. That's a very useful doctrine, kind of doctrine of change of course, wipe out history. It's invoked every few years. In fact, I've reviewed a lot of cases in print, but all that's irrelevant because this time it's different. How do we know it's different? Well, it's different because we say it's different, so therefore it's different. It's instructive to review examples, including some very recent ones. I'll again skip that for lack of time. You can return if you like. There is a scholarly variant of this, which is more serious. That does recognize that the historical record is pretty ugly, but the thesis is that we can dismiss all of that as what's called the abuse of reality, which is to be distinguished from reality itself. I'm quoting now. Reality itself is the unachieved national purpose, which is transcendent. When you get big words like transcendent, you know you're in academic scholarship. The transcendent national purpose is the establishment of equality and freedom. And if there's a departure from it, that's just abuse of reality. Actually, I'm quoting the founder of what's called realist international relations theory, and I want to stress that I'm not quoting it in criticism. He happens to have been a fine scholar and an unusually decent person, a few like him in the professional fields. Well, that happened to be 40 years ago. There's a current version of this, produced right around September 11th by a prominent and respected scholar in a leading prestigious journal. He writes that there's a guiding principle that defines the parameters within which the policy debate occurs. And this guiding principle is so authoritative as to be virtually immune from challenge, apart from tattered remnants of the right and the left. The principle is that history has a discernible direction and destination, and uniquely among the nations of the world, the United States comprehends and manifests history's purpose. Okay? Follows then that U.S. hegemony is the realization of history's purpose, and it's necessarily for the common good, and furthermore, this is a truism, so that facts are irrelevant. We should simply stand there and worship at the shrine. There's kind of a vulgar version of this that you read day after day from the president and commentators and so on. And this is this doctrine is not an innovation. It has a rather distinguished pedigree, in fact. It goes back a long time. So, for example, a century before Rumsfeld and Cheney, Woodrow Wilson called for the conquest of the Philippines because, as he put it, our interest must march forward, altruists though we are. Other nations must see to it that they stand off and do not seek to stay us. Sounds familiar. As we proceed to liberate the Philippines, also liberating several hundred thousand souls from life's torments. There were some critics, some obscure folk like Mark Twain, for example, and since fortunately we live in a free society, his criticisms, very bitter anti-imperialist essays, these are readily available. It's true 90 years later, but you can't have everything. And when they appeared, without a comment, at least that I could find, apart from the usual scoundrels, Wilson was just drawing from the highest peaks of European enlightenment in this regard, as anyone who's paid attention to the history knows very well. Well, all of that's one choice. The other choice is to understand reality to be reality, and to ask whether the unpleasant record of reality consists of flaws in the pursuit of history's purpose, or whether it has more mundane causes, as in the case of every other power system, past and present. That's a position that's known as anti-Americanism or hating America in the technical literature. Well, if we adopt that stance, saying U.S. is just like everyone else, and we join the tattered remnants that don't fall within the authoritative spectrum, I think we would be led to conclude, with regard to the main topic tonight, that policy choices are likely to remain pretty stable within a framework that's pretty well entrenched, enhanced, no doubt, perhaps in important ways, but fundamentally unchanged. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is the stability of the basic institutions. Power decisions do flow from them. But there are also narrower reasons, which merit a good deal of attention, I think. One of them I've already mentioned, the fact that the war on terror on September 11th was redeclared with the same rhetoric as 20 years before and most of the same people in charge. Remember that the Reagan administration came into office in 1981 announcing that a main focus of U.S. policy will be terrorism, particularly state-sponsored international terrorism, a plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself in a return to barbarism in the modern age. Actually, I'm quoting the administration moderate, George Shultz, who was the Colin Powell of his day. Well, the war on terrorism that was announced in 1981, that was going to focus on two areas where the plague was raging with unusual virulence. That was Central America and the Middle East. The greatest threat to civilization was Central America. There was a cancer right here in our landmass, which was planning to conquer the hemisphere and destroy the United States, openly announcing the goals of Mein Kampf. That's all George Shultz again. Well, luckily for us, the White House was occupied by a brave cowboy who stopped it. He declared a national emergency because, I'll quote his words, because the policies and the actions of the government of Nicaragua constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. He even had to bomb Libya for that reason. Libya was bringing the war home to the United States, he said, by providing arms to these monsters who were just on the verge of conquering the hemisphere. And that was part of the mad dog Gaddafi's effort to expel America from the world, the cowboy told us. So if you think there's a threat today, just remember what a narrow escape we had just a few years ago when it was really close. And it's not that people weren't frightened. It's very easy to frighten people. Every leader, dictator, Democrat, everyone else knows that. It's the last resort of real scoundrels and very effective. Well, that was one locus of the threat, the cancer right here in our hemisphere. The second locus, hardly less dreadful, was the Middle East Mediterranean region. If you run through the record of the 1980s, the Reagan years, that was constantly one of the top stories of the year. In the year 1985, it was, in fact, picked as the top story of the year in the annual poll, Associated Press poll of editors, and it ranked very high in other years. This also happens to be the primary focus of the redeclared war on terror.
Ready? Noam Chomsky speaking recently at the University of Houston. You are listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 800-881-2359. We'll be back with Professor Chomsky in a minute. Thank you. Anti-Balas, Battle of the Species, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we return now to Professor Noam Chomsky speaking last Friday night at the University of Houston.
Run through the record of the 1980s, the Reagan years. That was constantly one of the top stories of the year. In the year 1985, it was, in fact, picked as the top story of the year in the annual poll, Associated Press poll of editors, and it ranked very high in other years. It also happens to be the primary focus of the redeclared war on terror. So, again, rationality tells us that a closer look is very important, at least if we want to understand what's happening now and what lies ahead. Well, let's just take the peak year. 1985. What were the top terrorist acts of the region in that year? Well, there are actually three contenders. One of them was a car bombing in Beirut. Truck car bomb was placed out, was outside a mosque, timed to go off when people were leaving the mosque, and it did. It killed 80 people, mostly women and girls. It was a very powerful bomb, ripped up houses all the way down the street, killed infants in their beds, wounded a couple hundred people. However, that doesn't count. That's not part of the canon of terrorism. The reason is it was traced back to the CIA and British intelligence, so it's kind of off the record. The second contender for chief terrorist act in the region was the Israeli bombing of Tunis with no credible pretext. They barely tried, killed 75 people, also 85, expedited by the United States, praised by the United States right after the bombing and the killings. George Shultz called his Israeli counterpart to congratulate him and express U.S. support for this wonderful act. The U.S. sort of backed off and began to keep quiet about it when the Security Council met and condemned it unanimously, U.S. abstaining, as an act of armed aggression. Actually, notice that's worse than international terrorism. That means Nuremberg trials. But let's give the benefit of the doubt to the United States and its client and call it only international terrorism. The third contender for the prize was the so-called, what the Israeli government called its Iron Fist operations in southern Lebanon, occupied southern Lebanon. This is under the dovish labor government, Shimon Peres. The targets of the operations were what the high command called terrorist villagers. The atrocities reached new depths of calculated brutality and arbitrary murder, in the words of a Western diplomat in the area, amply supported by press coverage, mostly abroad, but some even here, plenty in Israel. Murder, atrocities, kidnapping, taking people back prison in Israel, and so on. That's the third act. Nobody knows the numbers, probably hundreds. Well, those are the three peak examples of international terrorism, or maybe worse, in the peak year of 1985. However, if you look at the scholarly literature, certainly media, they don't count. They don't enter the canon. Two incidents do enter the canon, exactly two. In each of them, one person was killed, in each case, an American. And those are not forgotten. Well, that tells you something about what terrorism is. It has nothing to do with terrorism. It has to do with whether they do it to us or we do it to them. And that's important to understand when you want to know something about the war on terror. Worst, and that's not a U.S. innovation, incidentally. As far as I know, that practice is universal, even among the worst mass murderers. So, say, take the Nazis. They didn't say that they were carrying out terror in occupied Europe. They were carrying out what they called counter-terror. They were protecting the population against the terrorism of the partisans who were terrorists directed from abroad. And like all propaganda, there's, you can imagine, there's an element of truth to that. The partisans did resort to terror. Now, they surely were directed from abroad. Nobody tried to deny that. And, you know, governments like Vichy had about as much legitimacy as the kinds of governments the U.S. and its allies set up throughout much of the world. And, in fact, if there's an exception to this practice, I've yet to find it. So the U.S. is breaking no ground on that. It's not a nice precedent, but it's not an innovation. Well, the worst atrocity, terrorist atrocity, if not aggression, of that period, the 1980s in the Middle East region, was the U.S.-backed Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which killed about 20,000 people. There wasn't even a pretext of self-defense. The operation was taken, as was openly proclaimed in Israel, in order to undermine efforts to reach a political settlement of the occupied territories that the United States and Israel didn't want. Well, that's a textbook example of international terrorism, again, if not aggression, in which case we call for Nuremberg trials. Without going on, in both of those two regions, both of the two regions which were the focus of the war on terror, the terrorist commanders in Washington, who are now once again in charge, they did compile a record of atrocities that vastly exceeded anything that could be attributed to their targets. In Central America, ended up with hundreds of thousands of people killed, four countries devastated, judgment of the World Court ordering the United States to cease its unlawful use of force, which is international terrorism. That was backed by the Security Council, or would have been, except that the U.S. vetoed a resolution supporting the World Court judgment and calling on all states to observe international law, considered so insignificant it was barely even reported here. The U.S. responded by escalating the terrorist war. That was the response to the order to terminate it, with including the first official orders to attack what the high command called soft targets, meaning undefended civilian targets, with the approval of liberal opinion, incidentally. The prime target throughout, one prime target, was the church, which the U.S. was fighting with, Catholic Church, which the U.S. was attacking with as much passion and intensity as it now directs to radical Islam. The church had committed a grave sin. The Latin American church had turned towards what was called the preferential option for the poor. Priests and nuns and others were working to organize poor peasants, help them take control over their lives. That's a sin. That's a crime. Can't be tolerated. The famous School of the Americas, now proclaims that one of its, what's called its talking points, that explains why it's a great place, that the U.S. Army helped defeat liberation theology, which is quite true. It's symbolic that that hideous decade in Central America began with the assassination of an archbishop who had become a voice for the voiceless, ended with the assassination of six leading Jesuit intellectuals, and of course, tens of thousands of the usual victims, and they're all unknown. You can do an experiment and ask your educated friends how many people have read anything written by the six leading Jesuit intellectuals who had their brains blown out by elite forces armed and trained by the United States. Who can even remember their names? If they had been Czech intellectuals who had suffered anything like that under the Russians, you'd know about it, but not in this case. It's an important principle that you should never know anything about your own crimes. And their educational system and intellectual culture are carefully designed to ensure that outcome. You can test it in this rather striking case. That's not the only example of Washington-based international terrorism in the 1980s. Another example is very much prominent right now. Iraq. Through the 1980s, Saddam Hussein did carry out horrendous atrocities. You can read Condoleezza Rice this morning explaining that we can't let this terrible man survive. He used chemical warfare in his war against Iran. He even used chemical warfare against his own people. Incidentally, they were his own people in the sense that the Cherokees were Andrew Jackson's own people. But we can forget that. Rice is absolutely correct. He carried all those atrocities, by far his worst crimes. She didn't mention, following the convention, that all of this was done with our help. I can't say that part. And it continued. The help had nothing to do with the Cold War. Clearly, Russia was also helping. It didn't have anything to do with the Iran-Iraq War either. We continued to give them the same assistance well after the worst atrocities that are now charged were well known, after the Iran-Iraq War was over. And the reasons were quite frankly stated. So the White House explained that providing Saddam Hussein with dual-use technology that enables him to develop weapons of mass destruction, which was in fact what was happening, those give great trade opportunities for U.S. companies and contribute to the stability of the region by supporting a moderate state. That went on right up to virtually the day of the invasion of Kuwait. Couple of weeks before the invasion, George Bush, number one, approved the sale of advanced data transmission equipment to his friendly SOB, as he was called. In the preceding couple of weeks, licenses had been approved for about $5 million worth of advanced technology products. That included computers for the Ministry of Industry and Military Industrialization and a research center that shortly after was destroyed by bombing on the grounds that it was developing rockets and poison gas, and another plant that was repeatedly bombed as a chemical weapons factory, and that's only a small piece of it. That went on, in fact, in the spring of 1990. George Bush, number one, who I guess is hiding out in Texas somewhere, sent a high-level senatorial delegation to visit his friend. This is the spring of 1990. Right before the invasion of Kuwait. It was headed by Bob Dole, later Republican presidential candidate. They brought George Bush's greetings, informed Saddam that he shouldn't be bothered too much by the criticism he's getting from the press here. We've got this free press thing, which is pretty hard to control, and sometimes reporters go off in weird directions. One of the senators even suggested to Saddam that he invite the press to come to Iraq so they could see for themselves and stop this criticism. So, yes, all of these hideous crimes took place with our aid and support, and the British as well. In fact, the British were a little slow on the draw, and they continued to provide Saddam with technology usable for weapons of mass destruction even a couple of days after the invasion of Kuwait. It took a little time to cut it off. So, yes, there were further atrocities in the 1980s during the so-called War on Terror. Well, that doesn't exhaust the record by any means. Things are happening elsewhere in the world, too. So, for example, take Africa. Washington's South African ally during the Reagan years alone was responsible for killing about 1.5 million people, over $60 million of damage in the neighboring countries. Forgetting South Africa. Meanwhile, Reagan was evading congressional sanctions and, in fact, even increased trade in the late 80s. UNICEF estimated that about 850,000 infants and young children were killed during those years, 150,000 of them in the neighboring countries. This is under South African attack. 150,000 of them in 1998. 1988, sorry. That's the year when Washington announced officially that It condemned officially what they called one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. That's Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. That's the end of the Reagan years, 1988. Well, that's just a brief glance at the first phase of the war on terror. It was a real age of terror, far beyond anything suffered by the rich and powerful then or now, but all out of history. You can check for yourselves, and in fact you know without checking, that none of this is considered relevant to the redeclared war on terror. The base of U.S. terrorist operations in Central America was Honduras. The ambassador to Honduras in the first part of the Reagan years was John Negroponte, who's now in charge of the diplomatic component of the new redeclared war on terror at the United Nations. The Reagan special envoy to the Middle East was Donald Rumsfeld, who's now Secretary of Defense. The National Security Advisor in the final years of the so-called war on terrorism is Colin Powell. Other leading figures then have now reappeared and hold prominent and important positions. Have they changed in some way? If so, what's the evidence? Has anybody asked whether they've changed? No. Because what they did then is considered apparently perfectly okay, maybe praiseworthy, and therefore irrelevant to the redeclared war with the same people and the same rhetoric.
Professor Noam Chomsky speaking last Friday night at the University of Houston. And if you would like to order a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Special thanks to Mark Pirtle and Houston Media Source for recording the night's event, and also to Dwayne Bradley, Professor Bob Bezenko, Hep Ingham, Otis McClay, and Scott Parkin. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is an engineer and music maestro sitting in for Anthony Recuperation Sloan. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Our email is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!